The In-Between is intended for mature audiences and may include topics that can be unsettling, such as emotional, physical, and sexual violence, rape, murder, and animal abuse. Testimony shared by guests of the show is their own and does not reflect the views of Mel Barrett, Ruby Grace Productions, or Grab Bag Collab. Listener discretion is advised.
Can we admit that we're all transfixed by that sick little soap opera trial in Exeter, New Hampshire?
What time did you get here today?
1:30 this morning.
1:30? Why?
Wanted to get a front row seat, I guess.
If this story were a made-for-TV movie, and it surely will be, you might not believe it.
It is August 1st, 1990. Time is 10 a.m. Seabrook, New Hampshire. We're about to do a one-party consent via telephone.
Sat around brainstorming the pros and cons of slitting a man's throat rather than firing a 38 caliber projectile through his head.
Yes.
There's only one person in the state of New York who is sitting in prison tonight with a sentence of life with absolutely no possibility of parole.
Yes, I need a policeman. 4D Misty Morning Drive.
Okay, what's going on over there, ma'am?
There's somebody screaming for help outside.
The ultimate mission, sell the most papers of anybody in the world.
It's the most perfectly placed piece of propaganda in America.
The most powerful people change the news narrative at will.
Look at the Enquirer in the realm of popular culture rather than journalism.
Get the story and don't come back until you have it.
We paid sources? Yes, we do. The JonBenet story.
Schwarzenegger.
Michael Jackson.
Princess Diana.
Cosby. Oprah sold a lot of papers.
This is the stuff that tabloid dreams are made of.
If we had had George Bush doing blow, we would have done it.
Welcome back to the In-Between podcast. I'm your host, Mel Barrett. In the past 7 episodes, we've taken a long, deep dive into the planning of the murder of Greg Smart, the trial, the conspirators. And now I feel it's time to talk about what happened after Pam Smart's sentencing by Judge Gray to life without the possibility of parole. Local New Hampshire reporter Bill Spencer took his newfound fame and ran with it. In previous episodes, I dropped in a snippet of Bill Spencer's starring role in the Helen Hunt made-for-television movie Murder in New Hampshire. But Bill had bigger dreams of stardom. KPRC, a local Houston television station, where Bill Spencer now works as an investigative reporter, dubbed Spencer the quote-unquote cameo king and lists his on-screen accomplishments thus. The aforementioned Murder in New Hampshire, Weird, True, and Freaky, You Don't Know Jack, a documentary about Jack Kevorkian, Scream 4, and of course Captivated, the Trials of Pamela Smart, and another documentary about the case called Pamela Smart, an American Murder Mystery. Here's Bill in Scream 4 playing reporter number 5. I watched the whole thing so you don't have to. You're welcome.
We're live at Woodsboro Community Hospital awaiting a first public statement from Jill Roberts, survivor.
A survivor of what is now being called the Woodsboro Massacre Reboot.
Bill Spencer made his name reporting on the Pam Smart murder case and, it seems to me anyway, built his persona on it. With his quintessential Trumpian swooped blonde hair and his booming voice, Spencer now has a show on KPRC called Spencer Solves It. He's a local celebrity and folks in the community write in to ask him to cover their stories or for help when they're in need. I think it's a good thing he's doing, don't get me wrong. Here's a snippet from Spencer Solves It.
That's when Lorraine wrote to me and the Spencer Solves It team.
Alas, in New Hampshire at least, Bill is still mostly known for his investigative reporting on the Pam Smart accomplice to murder trial. KPRC shared this quote on their website from Bill about his experience on the made-for-television movie Murder in New Hampshire. Quote, another fun fact is that he had dinner with Hunt when he arrived to film the movie. During dinner, they talked about what it was like for him to break the case and how Hunt studied his reports to provide an accurate representation of Smart. End quote. Spencer appeared on air as recently as 2019, KPRC's go-to expert on the Pam Smart accomplice to murder trial. Here's Bill.
The media coverage was massive. I was able to garner several exclusive interviews with Pamela Smart before she was eventually arrested. Tonight, she is the focus of a special Dateline NBC report, a story that I will appear in as well.
Bill Spencer was the appetizer for what would be a smorgasbord of media about Pam Smart post-trial. If you thought the news coverage couldn't become more sensational than it was pre-trial, you'd be wrong. The tropes that were developed by the prosecutors spilled over into the tabloids. Some folks think Pam didn't help herself because she, too, did as much press as she could. To some, that made her seem as attention-hungry as the reporters salivating over her case. She says that she was just trying to prove her innocence. Here she is speaking with Diane Sawyer on ABC News in 1995 from prison.
She was small, quiet, wary. This former honor student who graduated college in 3 years and had wanted to be a TV reporter.
You're going to be a journalist?
Yes.
You're going to be asking these questions?
Yes. My aspiration was to be a journalist and to be in the media, but this wasn't the idea that I had for myself, this part, being on the receiving end.
It was the first interview since her arrest.
Did you plan the murder of your husband?
No, I did not.
Did you know it was going to happen?
No, I did not.
Did you want him hurt?
No.
I spoke with one of Pam's best friends, Sonia, who testified as a witness for the defense in Pam's trial about the press coverage. Prosecutor Maggiato attacked Sonia in his cross-examination, bringing her to tears. She's one of those people I feel never really got to tell her truth on the stand. Here's Sonia in her own words.
This all started with Bill Spencer and him basically harassing Pam. I was there when she did that interview in the blue dress that she wore.
Yep.
With Channel 9. Okay, granted, she might have reached out to him as well, but she wanted to set the record straight. He and others were making accusations that it, before we knew about Bill and all that, that it was maybe a drug type of killing, you know, that he was, you know, not the decent man that he was, and trying to portray him wrongly. And she wanted to set the record straight with him and just share her love for him.
Yeah.
And they always, the media just always twisted everything she said. Anybody that supported Pam and spoke to any media, they would take clips and twist things and never report things properly, accurately. You know, that whole thing with her being a teacher.
Yeah.
They just always tried to manipulate the story and make it salacious, you know, because that's what we felt.
Let's be honest, the media is a double-edged sword, and we've all seen what disinformation can do to folks who don't fact-check, or who begin with confirmation bias. On the one hand, reporters who act with integrity and are only interested in the truth can help educate the public and hold people in power accountable. On the other hand, publications and individuals who want a scoop to sell units tend to sensationalize, making it difficult for some folks to decipher fact from fiction. I'm one of those people who believes journalism is a must in our society because it holds those in power accountable. It's my opinion that Bill Spencer was trying to tell the story of Greg Smart's death as best as he could. He had a lot of access and he tried desperately to get in front of the story to keep the public informed. But he did overstep on many occasions in pursuit of sharing the truth and getting in front of the camera. For instance, it was Bill Spencer who went on Geraldo as a guest alongside Linda Wojcicki, Pam Smart's mother, well before her daughter's trial, and told the audience she was guilty. This clip isn't available in the Geraldo archives, but did appear in Captivated. Since Captivated producer Lori Cheadle won't give me permission to use clips from Captivated, here's a reenactment. I wish you could hear this original audio because it's very powerful. Go check out Captivated to watch and listen.
Pamela told this 16-year-old girl many incriminating things.
Linda Wojcicki interrupted and asked Bill a very important question.
Did you hear the tape, Mr. Spencer? Did you hear it?
No, of course I didn't.
And you've made a judgment on my daughter based on not hearing that tape?
Later, Geraldo asks Bill.
Any chance that the media is on a runaway stampede with this case and this woman's not getting a fair hearing?
No, I don't think so. I think the real evidence is astronomical.
I think Bill going on national television and telling the audience that a woman who was presumed innocent until proven guilty was guilty before her trial even happened was at best distasteful and at worst completely unethical. And here's Bill being interviewed on local news about becoming a quote-unquote consultant on the Pamela Smart accomplice to murder case.
Reporter Bill Spencer was the first person to interview Smart after the murder. He's been covering and uncovering the sordid details of the case ever since. I hear this talk of a movie. I mean, is there going to be someone playing you, possibly? Are you at all involved in the possible dealings with that?
I understand there's going to be a couple of different movies, and I understand there will be a character that will play me. Mm-hmm. I don't know who that would be.
Are you going to give them a point of view in one of these?
Point of view?
Well, I mean, might one of these movies come from your point of view?
Oh, I don't believe so. I possibly will be a contributor to these movies, a consultant.
Bill was the first to report on the quote-unquote sordid details of the case, but he certainly wasn't the last, not by a long shot. In fact, his coverage may have started an avalanche of salacious stories that continues to trickle into the mainstream almost 35 years later. Perhaps the best-known supermarket tabloid, the National Enquirer, played a huge role in driving home the tropes of Pam Smart being a quote-unquote kinky teacher who seduced her teenage lover to kill her husband. So many people read those headlines while standing in line at the grocery store and believed what they were being told. It's a quote-unquote newspaper. They report the news, right? My nan, she believed just about everything she read in the Enquirer when I was a kid. When I was 18 and taking a Greyhound from Dallas to Boston, she called me the day before my trip and begged me not to get on the bus because she'd just read in the Enquirer that some young country singer who thought she was on her way to make it big in Nashville was found chopped up in the bathroom of the bus. Now, in Nan's defense, this was before cell phones and most Greyhound stations were sketchy as hell. And my bus was delayed for 5 hours in Connecticut when the bus driver refused to drive on until the person who smoked in the bathroom came forward. It wasn't me smoking in the bathroom, but it was my seatmate, Lonnie, whom I'd met at 8th and 33rd when he bummed a smoke for me in the middle of the night before boarding the bus. My nan and pop thought I was chopped up in the bathroom of a Greyhound and were freaking out by the time we pulled into Boston at about 3 a.m. Thanks, Enquirer. Thanks a friggin' lot. I'm taking the long way around this part of the story, but for good reason. I promise. Stay with me. After Pam Smart was sentenced, she was sent to the New Hampshire State Prison for Women in Goffstown to serve out her life sentence without parole. Shortly after her arrival, groups of supporters started showing up at the prison to protest her sentence.
There are many people who believe that Pam did not receive a fair trial and is innocent. Some of the friends of Pamela Smart, shown here at last weekend's fundraiser, and most would probably say that they are fighting for justice.
Her supporters started a newsletter, printed t-shirts and bumper stickers in a grassroots attempt to prove her innocence and protest her unfair sentencing.
Go ahead.
Hi, my name is Pam, and I'm calling from Manchester, New Hampshire. And I'm just calling to tell you that the media exposure up here, you couldn't go anywhere out of your own house, even in your own house, without knowing about the Pamela Smart case.
And what do you think that did?
I think that poor girl did not have a chance when she walked into that courtroom. By not sequestering that jewelry, there is no way that you can be tried in the same county where you live and where you work and expect to get a fair trial.
There was no way they could go home and not discuss the case. Is that what you're saying? Or hear something?
In my opinion, I mean, I'm sure they're very nice people, and I'm not saying there was any kind of, you know, infractions on them.
I think again of the Karen Reed supporters and their ability to bring awareness to the case by doing the exact same things Pam Smart supporters did back in the early 90s. What a difference the internet makes, though, huh? Go back to previous episodes of The In-Between for soundbites. You can also find a solid breakdown of the case on the 13th Juror podcast, and Rebecca Lavoie over at Crime Writers On has an amazing series on their Patreon called The Readathon. I highly recommend giving both a listen, but back to Pam Smart and her supporters.
So he's not, as far as I'm concerned, I think he was capable, you know, of committing this kind of a crime all on his own.
From Pam's family's side of things, the prison was growing frustrated with the supporters. That frustration, Linda Wojcicki believes, is what caused a several hours long disappearance of their daughter. More on where her missing incarcerated daughter was after the break. On March 11th, 1993, Linda and John Wojcicki were frantically trying to find out where their daughter was. The one place she wasn't? The New Hampshire Prison for Women in Goffstown. They were pleading for answers but weren't getting any information. Finally, they learned of Pam's whereabouts when a media report surfaced that she had been transferred out of New Hampshire to New York State. As Woja states in her book, To Live For, A Mother's Cry for Justice, quote, she was awakened at 4 a.m. and told to get dressed. She was bound and shackled and put in a van whose windows were covered and taken to Bedford Hills Correctional Facility in Bedford Hills, New York, end quote. When Wojcicki questioned Correctional Commissioner Ronald Powell why her daughter was transferred, he stated, quote, I thought I was doing you a favor. I could have sent her to Mississippi, end quote. But Wojcicki never received an answer as to why her daughter was transferred, with no warning given to her family or lawyers. United Press International reported that New Hampshire corrections spokesman Don Vino said that, quote, Mrs. Pamela Smart was transferred to a more secure facility in another state. This administrative move was made after due consideration for security reasons, end quote. Vino even went a step further and withheld the location of the transfer until Pam Smart arrived at the Bedford Hills facility. But why? I have not been able to uncover any reports about what the quote-unquote security reasons were, but I did speak with a local woman who asked that I not use her name, who had another story. I'll call her Stacy going forward. Here's Stacy telling me about what a family member who worked at the prison in New Hampshire while Pam Smart was there told her.
Well, she was starting to control all the prisoners because she was the infamous Pamela Smart, and she was using her sex again with the guards and with the prisoners. And she was caught on multiple occasions, and I'm going to say exactly what said, doing Jack Cousteau imitation.
Yeah, you heard that right. Jack Cousteau imitations.
I don't understand these questions.
This is a major subject for the public to know the truth about, because we're reading so many contradictory news. The Atlantis is found in the Atlantic, in the Pacific, in the North Sea, in the Sahara. I don't know where.
I'm not sure Jack Cousteau imitations are a security threat, but back to Stacy's story.
And they ended up going in, sweeping her, and moving her to New York, where she is not celebrated over there. In New Hampshire, she was like the queen of the prisons on TV, and she was this and that. And she went to a real prison in New York with real prisoners, and I heard that she's been beaten up, jaw's been broken, and yep. Blah, 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 blah.
Sadly, that part is true, and I'll get into it a little later in this episode. The Woges family has long accused the state of New Hampshire of playing politics when it comes to their daughter's life. It's hard to disagree with them when the same article about Pam's transfer published by UPI on March 11, 1993, states that Mrs. Judith Smart, Greg Smart's mother, said she wanted her former daughter-in-law moved to a higher security prison, and that her husband had asked the attorney general to do just that. The Smarts at this point had a relationship with the attorney general, and it's alleged that relationship was the catalyst to a chain of events that would change the Woges' life forever. As the Smarts' lives had been changed forever when their son was tragically murdered by Bill Flynn and Pete Randall. I don't want to forget that two families were torn apart by this murder, and that the Smarts lost their beloved son in a senseless act of violence. Too often victims are lost in these stories, and though the podcast is about Pamela Smart, I don't want to ever leave Greg out of this conversation. In a recent conversation I had with Pam, she had this to say about Greg.
Anybody who knows Greg knows that Greg never held a grudge. He was not an unforgiving person. He never held on to anything. When he got angry with his friends or whoever, he let things go. And so for the state to be claiming that they're holding this grudge, you know, for him and you know, in his stead is just ridiculous. Greg would not want me to be in prison, dying in prison, and remaining in prison for the rest of my life. He wouldn't. And anybody that thinks he would, like, really just denies who he was at the core of his being. And he was not a hateful person. He wasn't a vengeful person. He wasn't an angry person. And so to believe that he would want this for me is to say that he wants all of those things. And that's like disparaging his name. And so everybody that always wants to yell and scream about me, quote unquote, on behalf of Greg, where were these people when Greg's killers were getting released?
And as for Pam being transferred so far away from her family with no explanation, it seems the Smarts did have some sway with the attorney general, as most victims' families do. Judith Smart gave a quote to UPI, and I'll paraphrase here because the quote is a bit jumbled, but she said, "We were asking a while ago if she could possibly be moved from the New Hampshire State Prison for Women because we felt she had it really easy there. She was teaching and we just felt she had it really easy there. My husband had asked the attorney general if she could possibly be removed to a maximum security prison. He, the attorney general, said the only reason she could be moved is if it was a life-threatening situation. But no one working for corrections in the state of New Hampshire has ever publicly stated what life-threatening situation was happening that forced the 100-bed prison to transfer Pam Smart in the dead of night to an 800-bed high-security prison nearly 6 hours away from her family. And Judith Smart may have gotten her wish that Pam be moved someplace that was less easy for her, if by less easy she meant being attacked by a group of other prisoners upon arrival and having her cheekbone broken so badly she had to have a metal plate inserted into her face." Here's a reenactment of Pam Smart detailing what happened to her in a journal entry dated October 8th, 1996.
"Today I was assaulted by two other inmates. Apparently one thought I wrote a letter to the lieutenant about getting her moved. I did not write any such letter. While outside, I kept my eye on one of the inmates. All of a sudden, the other came out of nowhere and grabbed me by the hair. She just started assaulting me. I was trying to fight back, but she had my hair, so I couldn't really move. We ended up on the floor, and I ripped my pants open and got a huge gash on my knee. When I heard the officer's keys, I just laid there. She came and separated us. While I was standing there, one inmate pushed the officer aside and punched me in my face. Now I have a broken nose and a black eye.
To this day, Pam has very little feeling in her cheek and still has pain from the injury. I don't begrudge the Smart family their grievances. I imagine if my son had been brutally murdered in his home and my daughter-in-law had been found guilty of accomplice to his murder, I'd probably feel the same way. When I step back from it, though, and think about the fact that we're all human beings, I can't imagine wishing that brutal attack on anyone. And I certainly can't imagine wishing for what happened next to Pam Smart in the early part of her incarceration at Bedford Hills. Here's where I'll circle back to the media, specifically The Enquirer, and how fictionalized and sensationalized stories, be it the novel To Die For, the movie Murder in New Hampshire, or The Enquirer story, Pamela Smart, killer teacher sent lesbian lover after mother-in-law, created a need for some, including jurors from the trial, journalists, Pam's enemies and friends alike, to make money off of Pam Smart. Here's a reenactment of Pam writing in her journal again.
11/13/96. Today I was reading Star magazine, and there I was in it. Someone in here sold the story about my assault. I know who it was, too. One of my so-called friends. The Star turned the whole story into a lesbian love triangle, which it wasn't. They also said Greg was stabbed. That goes to show how untrue the whole article was. 2/26/97. Today, someone sent me an article that was about me in Reader's Digest magazine. The article was in a section entitled, That's Outrageous. The story was about how outrageous it is that I won a scholarship while in prison. It seems I can't do anything right. 6/16/98. The superintendent called me down today to inform me that a book has been written that includes a compilation of stories about famous women prisoners. The book is worse than a tabloid and includes a whole section on me. Apparently, another prisoner here met with the writer to help him put together this tawdry tale. This is the second time this girl sold a story about me. This is the last thing I need right now while I'm waiting for the judge to make a decision in regard to my appeal. I don't know when this madness will stop. Today, I took down all the photos of my family and friends that I had on the cell wall. I'm afraid someone might steal photos of me to sell for profit.
So many documentaries have been made about Pam Smart since the 90s, but in my opinion, they're all a sanitized version of what the National Enquirer and Bill Spencer started with. Sexy teacher seduces poor innocent boy into killing her husband for insurance money. As I've laid out for you over the past 8 episodes, that is far from the real story, but these corporations have to make money, and sex sells. So they boost the sex angle and downgrade the constitutional rights violations angle in an attempt to sell more ads, newspapers, and magazines. Even the documentary Captivated, which got me thinking about my own bias about Pamela Smart, sells the story as a trashy concept. Here's the first sentence of the synopsis from the Hardworking Movies website.
Pulsating with sex, drugs, murder, and betrayal, a small-town New England murder became one of the highest-profile cases of the past 25 years.
When I titled the second episode of this podcast Resting Bitch Face, I had people coming out of the woodwork even before the episode aired to give me an earful about how I was just doing the same thing to Pam that all media does. This is a good lesson to do your research before you complain about something on the internet, but I digress. My episode 2 of The In-Between was about exactly what I'm railing against here. The tropes we paint with a broad brush when it comes to women and crime. Let's stop doing that, okay? I recently spoke with Diane Diamond, well-known journalist and author, who has tried to explain this story before in documentary form, but found the story and any control she had over it falling to the corporate gods of greed and tabloidery. Here's what Diane had to say.
When we went to interview for this Court TV thing that we did, and I was so mad because I got access to Pam, I got the interview, I got the everything, and then they took control of the documentary away from me,
yeah.
Which just took me off.
Yeah.
But we got Maggiato. I said to the producer who went to interview him, I said, you have to ask him who transcribed tapes. And he clearly says, I don't know, some secretary.
This is why we've never heard the real story of what happened in New Hampshire in the early 90s. Even 7 years after her sentence began, folks were still trying to make money off of Pam Smart's incarceration by selling trashy stories about her. 10 years in, the profiteers took a dangerous and lucrative turn in their attempts. More on that story after a quick break. Pam Smart doesn't write about what happened to her and a fellow inmate in her journals until much later after the fact. There isn't a lot of detail about the heinous crimes that took place behind the bars at Bedford Hills, but I'll detail what we do know from the news sources and the aftermath that Pam wrote about in her journal. In 2004, Pam Smart and fellow inmate Carolyn Warmus filed a federal lawsuit against the New York State Department of Correctional Services claiming sexual harassment and sexual assault by corrections officers. Pam alleged that an officer coerced her into posing for photos in her underwear as collateral for staying quiet about what he had done. He threatened her with the death of her family if she told anyone at the prison and let her know that he knew her family's addresses. The guard's then-girlfriend sold the photos to the National Enquirer, yeah, them again, and the photos were published in 2003. Well, that's a lot of info. Let's unpack it a bit. I want to introduce you to Carolyn Warmus first. Carolyn Warmus is a former elementary school teacher who was convicted at age 28 of the 1989 murder of her lover's wife, 40-year-old Betty Jean Solomon. Think of the movie Fatal Attraction, because that's what this case was compared to.
What am I supposed to do? You won't answer my calls. You change your number. I mean, I'm not going to be ignored, Dan.
In Warmus's first trial in 1991, the jury was hung. In the second trial in 1992, Warmus was convicted of second-degree murder and illegal possession of a firearm. She served 27 years and was released on parole on June 17, 2019. Warmus said she was sexually abused by prison guards, saying she'd been raped and forced to trade sexual favors for basic privileges. Lieutenant Glenn Looney was named as Warmus's abuser and was arraigned at Bedford Court on April 15, 2004, on a charge of second-degree sexual abuse. Warmus was able to show proof that she'd been raped because she was able to provide prison officials with a sample of Looney's semen that she had kept refrigerated in plastic. In 2008, Warmus received $10,000 from the Department of Correctional Services in a settlement of the lawsuit. For some reason, in all of the research I did on Warmus and Smart's lawsuit, I was unable to find the name of Pam's rapist, and Pam is legally not allowed to speak about this matter as the case was settled. Pam also received a settlement from the state of New York, $23,875, of which Pam received $8,750 after her lawyers took their cut. Here's Dr. Eleanor Pam, one of Smart's representatives, explaining what happened to Pam to Rita Cosby of NBC News. Unfortunately, no sound bites are available, so Daisy Egan will be playing the part of Rita Cosby, and Ellen Marsh will be playing the part of Dr. Pam, Pamela Smart's teacher and representative.
He came in one time, and then 2 days later he came back, and he said that he didn't want to lose his job in case she told, so he needed some extra insurance, and he took pictures of her. He demanded first that she strip naked, and she refused to do that. She thought actually he was coming back to rape her. And she finally talked him out of that part of it, but agreed to pose in some lingerie. Well, the National Enquirer got those pictures from the girlfriend of the guard who was the rapist.
You know, and now she comes forward and says, look, this is what happened to me by a guard. What did the prison do? Did they investigate the guard?
What they did was arrest her. They came and they put her in handcuffs and they threw her in solitary. And the basis of the arrest was the National Enquirer article, which is amazing.
Yes, because in fact, let me show you. This is a letter from the National Enquirer. They write, Pamela Smart was not the source of the picture or is not connected in any way to the source of the exclusive photographs obtained by the Enquirer and published in an article about Smart in the June 3rd, 2003 issue. They say it right there, but then they went back. Who did they say released it? Who did the prison allege took the pictures and distributed them?
Well, the prison and the administrative superintendent's hearing suggested very explicitly that Pam herself took the pictures of herself, that, I don't know, somehow she smuggled in this camera, put a timer on it, took the pictures, got them developed somehow, and that, you know, I don't know, God knows what other fantasy. It's very clear that this is a criminal act by a rapist who not only abused and assaulted her illegally, because even if they were consensual in prison, there's no such thing as consensual sex. It's statutory rape, no matter what it is. But in this case, he blackmails her, extorts her, harasses her, threatens her, talks about killing the parents, comes back 2 days later, takes the pictures illegally, and then has the nerve to have his girlfriend sell them and write a bogus story and profit off that.
When the National Enquirer published the photos they'd bought from the guard's girlfriend, Pam was punished by the prison. She spent 3 months, as in 90 days, in the SHU, or the Secure Housing Unit, i.e. solitary confinement. Or as some of the prisoners call it, quote-unquote, 23-in-1. Because you spend 23 hours a day in solitary with a one-hour break to shower, make a phone call, and in some cases go outside. As the New York American Civil Liberties Union puts it, quote, solitary confinement that lasts more than 15 consecutive days is recognized by the United Nations and various human rights organizations as torture, end quote. Why is it instinct for some to punish women first when they've been assaulted and to ask questions later? Maybe it's because misinformation, disinformation, and sex sells? Maybe when the media paints a salacious picture of the quote-unquote Black Widow seductress to sell tabloids, sometimes those images stick. When those images stick, they become embedded in people's brains until they can no longer decipher fact from fiction. Take Detective Pelletier, the lead investigator into Greg Smart's murder, who wired Cecilia Pierce, arrested Pam Smart, and testified against her in the trial. Even he has to jog his memory of what actually happens sometimes by referencing Steve Zawicki's true crime book, Teach Me to Kill. He's the police. He is referencing a book that relies on secondhand knowledge of his own investigation, probably the biggest investigation of his life. Here's a reenactment of Detective Pelletier from the HBO documentary Captivated.
Can I just check one fact?
Sure, go ahead.
Teach Me to Kill. This is Steve Zawicki's book. He was formerly People Magazine. Whenever I have to prepare for an interview, I like to call that my Bible. We'll go back and just, it refreshes my memory about things that happened during the case. Sometimes the memory fades with time, so.
I wonder who else was swayed by the media coverage of the Pam Smart accomplice to murder trial besides the public and the jurors. Were you? Were your family members? Like mine were? I wonder if being thrown in solitary confinement for months on end as punishment for appearing in her underwear in a tabloid after being raped and threatened is the kind of prison sentence Judith Smart felt was less easy for Pam Smart. Is this what this woman deserves? Don't forget, she proclaims she is innocent of planning the murder of Greg Smart and has done so for 34 years. How would you feel if you were in her shackles? I've spent 8 episodes diving deep on this case and sharing what I've found with you, so you can better understand how it happened that Greg Smart's wife, Pam, is living a life without parole sentence for planning his murder, which he has adamantly denied for 34 years. Have you made up your mind yet about her guilt or innocence? Have you made up your mind about her sentence? I'm still digging, so I'm not going to tell you where I stand until I've turned over every stone I can. There's a lot there. My only opinion right now is that if this trial happened today, it would have a very different outcome. And I feel like I'm just barely scratching the surface here. There's more to tell, including Pam's legal team's appeal for a new trial, the final call on the fingerprints at the crime scene, wiretap analysis, jury psychology and analysis, and deeper interviews with experts, Pam Smart and those closest to her, and those who hate her. I'm also working on season 2 of the In Between podcast, and holy hell, it's a doozy. More on that soon, I promise. In the meantime, if you feel strongly about this case, please get involved. Write to legislators in New Hampshire, asking them to take a look at their life without parole sentencing laws for folks under the age of 25. Donate to the legal team. You can go to payit2.com and search Pamela Smart. Show up if there's a new trial. Let your voices be heard. Share this story far and wide. Some people will be hearing the real story for the first time, even if they think they know what happened. Let's get to the bottom of this once and for all. For now, dear listeners, I want to say thank you. Thank you for listening. Thank you for sharing this show. Thank you for reposting. Thank you for your feedback. Thank you for debating with me. Thank you for having an open mind and heart. There's a lot more to come, and I hope you'll be there when it comes. Be good to yourselves and to those you love, and don't do murder. The In-Between is written, edited, and hosted by me, Mel Barrett. I also do some of the audio editing, but I couldn't content edit this sucker without the amazing Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Amber Hunt, my editor. Amber keeps me on track and helps cut the bullshit. Thanks, Amber. Thanks as well to my research partner and cousin-in-law, Lacey Umble. I also couldn't get this done without the kick-ass team at Grabbag Collab, Amber Hunt, Amanda Rossman, and Daisy Egan. The In-Between wouldn't exist without the encouragement and support of my dear friend, fellow podcaster, and all-around rock star, Yellen Marie Marsh. I love you, Ellen. Thanks for all you do. And I want to send another shout-out to Rebecca Lavoie over at Crime Writers On, who gave me my first feedback on the series and encouraged me to pitch it. Thanks, Rebecca. Finally, my love, my partner, Lindsay. Your support and belief in me always keeps me moving forward, even when the way ahead is very dark. Thanks for doing this with me. Also, your reenactments are my favorite. If you want to dive deeper into the cases I cover, visit inbetweenpod.com for source material and updates. You can find all the episodes and bonus content of The In-Between on the Grabbag Collab main Patreon feed.